Okay, well, thanks for coming. I'm going to talk about something that has baffled me most of my life, and I won't finish yet, but this is as far as I've been able to take the topic. The basic issue that I've always wondered about was Laplace wrote a book on celestial mechanics and showed it to Napoleon, and Napoleon said, you have written this book about celestial mechanics without mentioning God. And Laplace gave his reply, sire, I have no need of that hypothesis. And Napoleon went away and thought about it, and he said, well, what room is left for providence? If we can describe the natural world without referring to God, which many people practically do today, then is God superfluous? Is he an object that beauty reminds us of, but with no real practical applied value? And if so, then we have a very different view of God to the God of Judeo-Christianity. So I'm going to take a long step back to the Greeks, and in particular to Parmenides, one of the Greeks that writes Greek philosophers. And both science and providence claim to explain change. Change was something that bothered the Greeks, and in many ways they have deeply affected Western culture. What is change? What is it that changes, and what is it that causes the change? Oops, sorry. Okay. So Parmenides' thinking was, caterpillars become butterflies and tadpoles become frogs. And so I believe that all change is the change in one thing. One thing cannot become another thing almost by definition. And so change is only a change in appearance. Okay. Empedocles followed up and agreed with Parmenides that reality was changeless, but he said it's not an illusion. Change is caused by changes in the position of four basic elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And the cause of change is love, which unites, and strife, which divides. And in this way, he was remarkably prescient, because we do have basic elements. They're called fermions. And the forces of change that change the fermions are called bosons. Another step forward was taken by Anaxagoras, who said that nous, or mind, not love and strife, is the agent of change. And so he believed there was an all-pervading mind which imposes an intelligible pattern in an otherwise unintelligible universe. Nous affects things without being in them. And so in many ways, he articulates a Christian doctrine of providence sustained by one God. According to Heraclitus, contemplation of the nous, or the logos, which is used, the first person to use the word logos, contemplation of God is the path to wisdom. God is... So the Bible might have said there's a problem with Heraclitus. He's seeking God through contemplation and the mind. And we've had a great deal of affirmation of this idea in this conference, that by using our minds and looking at the natural world and God's creation of the natural world, we learn something about God. I seem to be going backwards here or something. It doesn't matter which one I hit, it's taking me backwards. Okay, it's going back. Okay, now we're going. You might argue that God is known by inspiration in the heart, primarily rather than through the operation of the mind. The Greeks were the ones that really affirmed that truth was established by reason. St. Thomas embraced this idea, the philosophy of Aristotle, as theology, and regarded spiritual fulfillment as enjoyment of the beatific vision, which is, in some sense, finding God through beauty. The science of the Enlightenment radically challenged Greek philosophy and scholastic theology. And the mortal blow was struck by Isaac Newton's first law of motion. So Newton's first law said that all substances consist of particles that follow the same laws of motion. So Aristotle had every substance had a form, and the form operated on matter, and so everything was kind of different and unique. And Newton said, no, that's all mumbo-jumbo. Everything consists of particles that follow the same laws. Vitalism was an illusion. Mechanism was the ruling force of nature. And to some extent, then, providence was unnecessary. Newton himself, of course, was a deist. He didn't believe in a god, maybe a god who was a clockmaker. But he wound up the universe and let it run according to these laws. And so we have Laplace's comment to Napoleon: all the effects of nature are only the mathematical consequences of a small number of immutable laws. And that was his comment. I have no need of that hypothesis. So science became, and still in many cases for many people, is the savior. Well, science has its problems, because experts tell us that science simply adds to the confusion. For example, Feynman's well-known remark, I think I can safely say nobody understands quantum mechanics. Niels Bohr: if quantum mechanics hasn't profoundly shocked you, you haven't understood it yet. So here's how I'm going to run through this fairly quickly. Some paradoxes that I suddenly hit as an undergraduate and had to kind of work my way through as I got older. Particles can be waves and can be in two places at the same time. Cats can be both dead and alive at the same time. The universe exists in multiple copies. Space can contract and time can expand. Mass can turn into energy and energy can turn back into mass. All events, events are not caused by a chain of cause and effect. And Einstein's famous comment, God, I don't like the idea that God can play dice with the universe. What Feynman called the key experiment to understanding quantum mechanics is the two-slit interference pattern. So we take waves, doesn't matter what kind of waves they are, we pass them through two slits, and the waves will form bars on a screen. The reason they can do that is waves have extent, and so a wave from this slit overlaps a wave from this slit because they have extent and they're able to overlap, and the pattern that comes out at the end is an interference pattern. Well, the problem is that the pattern can be built up with particles. So we can send one particle at a time. If it goes through this slit, then it lands on the screen. If it goes through this slit, it lands on the screen. But it doesn't wash over the whole screen. It forms the same interference pattern, although it's a particle which does not have extent, but has locality. So the characteristic of a particle is it can be found in one place. And the mystery deepens if you cover up one of the screens. If you cover up one of the bars here, then the particle does not form the interference pattern. In some sense, the particle going through one screen is affected by whether the screen is blocked off or not. So this open or closeness of the screen affects the particle going through the other screen, which means it doesn't have locality. And this was masterfully handled by Niels Bohr, who said the photon goes through both screens. It only implies position where it's detected. So you have a particle and a ghost particle, or a ghost particle and a particle. And somehow the ghost combines with the real particle when it's observed. This is called the observer effect. And so Schrodinger spoof this by saying, well, that means cats can be dead and alive at the same time. And so a dead cat can come back to its alive cat and say, I know about the afterlife because I've been there. I was dead and now I'm going to tell you because you're still alive. So there are all kinds of jokes that were made about this. But this is a serious, seriously articulated. The universe can exist in all possible permutations. So boy meets girl, they hit it off, the universe goes forward this way. They don't like each other too much, so the universe unfolds this way. And so we have literally billions upon billions of possible universes that only become the universe, the observed universe, by some event taking place, by some decision being made. So each event collapses the number of possibilities and creates reality. And you know, the interesting lecture on probability has something to say about this. So according to the Copenhagen School, the cause of events is the observer effect. Reality only exists when it's observed. Einstein never liked that, and he said, I don't like to believe the moon is only there if I look at it. Which in a sense is being said. So summing up the first part, according to classical physics, the collision of particles is the cause of events. We must have particles with locality, space between them, time between a particle being here and here for the laws to work. So there are certain premises that Newton's laws require. If you're going to predict events by laws of motion, then something must move, which means it must be here and get to here, which means you must have time, and there must be a separation, which must be space. So space, time, and particles are a bit like temperature and money. They're useful things to describe what's going on, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have objective reality. Now, Newton would push the envelope and say they do have objective reality. If there were no particles, it would still be space and time. Now, that's a statement of faith or of error. It's not a statement of necessity. Just as the temperature of something isn't something fundamental, it's a measure of the average kinetic energy of molecules. Money is not something that exists in and of itself. It's a way of describing transactions. So I want to try and argue, and I may be going on a bit of a limb here, that space-time and particles are not necessarily required. So for laws to operate, Newton needed particles in an infinite space and an infinite time. Watch my time here. A different view was taken by the Marquis de Maupertuis and his principle of least action. So Maupertuis says the reason a particle, if you throw a particle, it follows the trajectory of a parabola. But it could go this way or this way, except the parabola is the most efficient way. So nature with a capital N, and we could say God, is the most efficient way for things to happen. So Newton would say common sense and causality means that an object can't know where it's going before it leaves where it is. So in order to calculate the most efficient path, somebody or something or nature must know the particle is going to go from here to here. It has to know where it's going to go before it can calculate the required paths. And so it must have some kind of, there must be some kind of mind behind that for that to happen. Feynman appreciated that. He said, is it true a particle doesn't just take the right path, but it looks at all the other possible trajectories? The miracle of it all is, of course, it does just that. It's just a particle takes the path of least action, but it smells all the paths in the neighborhood and chooses the one that has the least action. So I'm going to run through a couple of examples here. What is action? There are three equations. The photoelectric effect has something called Planck's constant in it. The wave particle duality articulated by de Broglie has Planck's constant in it. Heisenberg uncertainty principle has Planck's constant. All three of them contain Planck's constant, and if you do some very simple math on Maupertuis' expression for action, you get action equals a product of momentum, the momentum of the particle, and its position. Well, formula, action equals Px, is the same as Heisenberg's formula for the uncertainty principle. So we can put the two ideas together, the real nickel mathematics here, and we can say that Planck's constant, this fundamental constant that keeps popping up all over the place, is really due to a change in something called action. So it's these changes in action that create the events that occur in space and time. Newton, I think events are due to a chain of cause and effect. Action is the thing that causes events in space and time. So the universe contains trillions of action levels. Emission and absorption of the Planck constant creates an event. Parmenides rubs his hand and says, "See, I told you, all is one." For his laws to operate, Newton needs particles in infinite space and time, and these laws force him to cause events are determined by chain of cause and effect. And quantum field theory, which is our best theory at the moment of reality, would say there are no particles. What we think are particles are really excitations in a field.
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Yeah. John Bell, there are no fixed values. Measurement determines the value of one component and only one. So nature exists in potentiality. Action units measured by Planck's constant create one event at a time. There's no Newtonian cause and effect. Nature is a pointless. You make a picture with dots. It doesn't matter whether you make the sand first and then the hill and then the umbrella, or make the umbrella and then the hill and then the sand. The picture ends up being the same. And quantum mechanics is like that. You always get, generally, the effect that you want. But the order in which things happen is arbitrary. Well, this opens the door for a number of things. It opens the door for miracles. It doesn't mean that the final effect must always be the same. So it's not causal in the Newtonian sense. It also has something to say about time. There's no linear time. And even block time, you could argue, the idea of block time and relativity, to some extent, could be up for grabs. So Aristotle, I'm going to put a little bit of Aristotle's theology in here. Aristotle would argue that God is uncaused. He's the unmoved mover and so on. Nothing can move God, nothing can cause God to become more godlike, because then he would be God. So if God acts, he has a single wrench that he can act through, and that's called action. And action, if we like, is the second cause behind nature. Kant struggled to find, after the scientific message, he struggled to get an entry into metaphysics. And if he knew about Maupertuis, he might have saved himself a lot of trouble. So action clears up the mystery thanks to the Marquis de Maupertuis. And I haven't got a lot of time here, so I'm going to skip through right to the end. And I'm going to... jump to the bottom here and deal with an element of providence that deals with us. So I've talked about how providence operates, or might operate in nature, but it's in some sense more important that we discuss how he operates in us, in our spirits. So this is the best world that we have allowed God or providence to make, because God requires our cooperation. Providence cares for the material through action, and he cares for the spiritual through charism, through inspirations in our minds and spirits. Diocletian divided the Roman Empire into a Western church, which emphasizes a rational approach, and that I think would be true of both the Catholic and Protestant branches. Whereas the Eastern Church has emphasized a mystical approach to God. And Aquinas, who really embraced the rational, even at, later in his life, he said that God showed me all my writings have been a straw, and he never wrote another word. So with the witness of the Logos only, we know God by reason alone. Always the danger of Western Christianity. With the witness of the Spirit only, we would know God by intuitions alone. And so that's always the danger of charismatic Christianity. So both the Son, the Logos, and the Spirit are needed to bear witness to the Father. It's nice to finish.
Yeah, thank you. We have time for questions.
Thank you for your interesting talk. What is it that you have in view when you talk about God's providence? Like, what's required for God to be providentially in control?
Okay, I think everything happens with God's permission, and in that sense, under his control. Do I mean by that God exercises control over everything? In a sense, but he gives the control, he gives the permission to autonomous agents, if you like, to exercise, to do their job. And so, I would take a more Eastern, I'm an Anglican, but I would take a more Eastern view of this, that God's providence acts not just in our thinking, but it acts in all aspects of our mental life, our emotional life. And I didn't have time to go into this really, but a charism, as I understand it, is an idea, but it also has an emotional power. So whereas the Greeks would kill the passions, and certain Western universities would say the passions are dangerous, we want to get rid of feelings and purify our, in order to purify our thinking, I would be very suspicious of that. I don't believe that. I think that intuitive knowledge is very, very important. And the intuitive knowledge, you then think about that and you rationalize that. But I don't want an argument as to why I should not go around killing people. You know, there might be an argument when I made possible that I should go around. It's an intuition that tells me I shouldn't do certain things.
Unless you're a person who has an intuition that you should be go around killing.
Well, that's right, and that's why said that idea. And then, of course, the Germans that did that had to be treated for psychological injury because they were horrified at what rational minds were telling them to do. And I think that's much more important. I think the reason, again, the Greeks, the Orthodox, you go into the mind first. Sorry, you go into the heart first. You draw the mind into the heart and you pray. If you use your mind to pray, you pray from the starting point of the heart. And, I tried practicing some. It's a very much better way than to think about what God would want and get 15 concordances on the Bible and try and analyze them over 3 years to, you know. I think there's a more direct way. So to answer your question about what I think providence is, it's a complicated answer. It's everything. But from a practical viewpoint, providence is something that acts in the spirit, spiritually in your heart, then in your mind. So it makes sense.
So clearly Newton made the very idea of God acting in the world very difficult, and hence Laplace ultimately says, I have no need of that hypothesis. And now it seems like quantum is opening the situation up again. But I just wonder about that temptation to tie our theological notions to certain understandings of physical reality, like to quantum mechanics now, as opposed to Newtonian mechanics. I mean, is that a good idea?
No, it's a bad idea. I'm not trying to do that. What I'm trying to do is to point out that there is an opening. That this may not be the opening. It just shows that it's not a closed system the way it was under Newton and the way it still is in the medical profession. You know, I mean, when somebody is ill, we give them chemicals that have a Newtonian effect. Now, we don't deal yet with spiritual conditions professionally in a spiritual way, I don't think. So I'm merely trying to point out there are flaws within science. There are flaws in the paradigm, the scientific paradigm that is followed practically. I'm not trying to say if you study quantum physics, it's going to get you to God. No.
Okay.
I think you get to God the way I just said a minute ago.
Okay.
That's much more. And it's much more accessible for everybody. You know, do I have to study quantum mechanics in order to go to church?
It helps.
Next, my question was much similar. I don't think I understood what you meant when you had the pixelated screen up there and said this opens the door for God's providence. Doesn't either a Newtonian world or a quantum world require for providence? Maybe I'm not understanding your definition. Divine intervention, thus the manipulation with that reality.
Right.
Why does quantum a world make it easier for God to intervene than in a Newtonian world?
Well, because in the Newtonian world, a cause, an effect is due to a cause in a chain of events. So it's, you know, the boxcar hits the boxcar, which hits the other boxcars. And so you have mechanism. There's no room for a boxcar called God to come in and change anything. The world is programmed and it runs according to its program. That doesn't work within the scientific world itself. There are one-off events. There's no boxcar. There's no collision. It's an event, an event, an event. We don't know. These events occur randomly, statistically. We don't know why they add up to a consistent pattern. But they don't have to. If you want to believe in miracles, you don't have to believe in a special system that contradicts, that is contradicted by something called a miracle. The whole picture is a unified picture of discrete events. We know from physical arguments that that's the case. Now, one of the problems, of course, is that ridiculous things are made on this basis. Science has faith in some of these essentially metaphysical ideas, and it runs with them. And so we have the multiverse, and we, I mean, you know, silly things that the universe is in the brain of a computer. And I don't even bother to read the stuff. But you see where I'm going. All I'm trying to do is to say that the scientific paradigm that exists as it's commonly understood, is flawed. And then I would go to some other way to access God.
Maybe just conclude with one last question.
Well, I think over here.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, what you're describing seems to me where artificial intelligence and machine learning is going.
That
you don't pre-program a machine like Watson to do certain things, but it's general purpose. Right. And so you have this unpredictability.
Yes, artificial intelligence is a good example. I mean, how does a machine assign value that's not what's the word?
Pre-programmed.
Well, no, you need some basis on which to assign value. There's not I would say certain values are metaphysical. Beauty, what we were talking about. How does a robot know what is beautiful without being told what to look for that's called beautiful? And so if there's a kind of functional aspect, then a robot can do something. It can think if it's got a function to perform, like playing chess. But if it has, let me give it a very simple example. The Mad King Ludwig of Bavaria wanted to know what the first language was. So he's up here in his head. And he had 30 babies that were kept in a nursery, and the nurses were told not to speak to them. And the babies all died within a month because apparently babies need to be spoken to. Now, if you made the nurses speaking robots, I don't know. You know, it's an open question whether that would have done the job. So there is something that's deeply within us that a robot cannot do. It can do things like run into burning buildings and rescue people.
Yeah, but it seems that the gap.
There is a gap.
The function and the actual person, what it means to be in person.
Indeed.
Is being explored at this level.
It is. I think that goes back to the paradigm of the mind, though, that we have. From the Greek and in Western Christianity, we have plenty of examples around where You know, God was pure activity, actus purus. So we sat and looked at God. That isn't the New Testament view of God. God is not actus purus that we stand, sit and look at and admire and say, oh, how wonderful he is. He is something dynamic within our personalities that gives us the ability to do things and be things that we couldn't do by ourselves. The idea of sitting and improving our mind to look at God and contemplate the beauty of things, that is not New Testament Christianity, but it's become it, sadly.
Right, it's incarnational.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm questions at the end.
My time, I think.
Well, thank you for the speaker again.